from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Tomorrow's Father's Day, and I'm celebrating by firing up the grill. I'll introduce you to Santa Maria Barbecue today on the show, regulating farmers markets in California, plus how a group of nuns are successfully challenging fast food giant McDonald's. And Jonathan Gold's here with a restaurant for us to try. But first, let's head out to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, where Laura Avery has a look at what's fresh and in season right now in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're so excited that there's a new cooking school within blocks of the Santa Monica Farmers Market. And Clemence Gosset is the owner and founder of the Gourmandise School of Sweets and Savories. It's located in the market on the third floor of Santa Monica Place. And Clemence is here today at the Farmers Market to demonstrate some of her cooking techniques. And Clemence, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the origin of the school and why you're so excited to be here in this location?
Our sort of main objective is to use all locally sourced products. So, you know, all the fruits and vegetables that we procure for our classes come from here at the farmers market. We use Nate's almond from Fat Uncle Farms a lot. We love Pudwill berries. We use Alex Weiser's carrots for our carrot cake. And so when we send out our e-newsletter once a week with a recipe of classes, it tends to be driven by the seasons. So it's really great for us to be here at the farmers market just three blocks away, because we can come up here every Wednesday and Saturday, get everything that we need for the week.
We can actually shop at the market, and then we can all walk back to Santa Monica Place, go up to the third floor, and you've graciously allowed us the use of your fabulous kitchen facility for farmers market cooking demos, and we're so excited.
We're so excited, too. We are going to be partnering up a chef, either from the market or from the surrounding area, and a farmer, and having them come and do a free demonstration for the public every Wednesday and Saturday morning from 9 a.m. till noon, and really feature what's available locally and in season, along with the talents of the chefs that are nearby.
Great, come on. Thank you so much. We're very excited that you're here. A seasonal favorite here at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market is Kincaid Farm. It's owned by Robert Poole, who is a farmer along with his son and grandson, who's actually here today, who bring in the most anticipated berries, young berries in particular. It's a form of, I guess, what most people would think of as a blackberry. And Robert, you uniquely grow this berry in addition to some blackberries and, I guess, boysenberries too. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the young berry and what makes it so unique.
Well, we think it's the sweetest of all blackberries. Very hard to pick, very small berry, very short bearing season of 2 or 3 weeks.
What is it about the young berry that made you plant it in the first place?
Well, the sweetness, the pleasant, very, very pleasant flavor, kind of like ambrosia. Sweetest blackberry I'd ever found. Mm-hmm. Boysenberry, though, is, I think, a better cooking berry. In a cobbler or a pie, boysenberry topped with vanilla ice cream and a little whipped cream, you just can't beat it.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the blackberry. You also have those?
I do.
Okay.
They're taking over. I think they'll be in the house by next year.
They're really
very invasive. And they have thorns that are, well, one thorn is in my finger here and I can't get out.
But all of them have thorns, don't they?
But the blackberry's the worst.
The worst. Okay.
It's carnivorous. It grabs you by the shirt and won't let go.
Yes. Now, you're out in Redlands, so is that really prime berry growing because it's nice and hot?
Well, the heat seems to get the sugar up, and that's a major factor.
Mm-hmm.
Gives better flavor because you suffer, and the berries suffer.
And then they taste better.
Yes.
Right. And how long are you going to be bringing these in? I know your season every year is different.
Usually about 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And you'll have the young berries all the way through June?
And then I have 11 months to recover.
Right. And try to talk your kids back out into picking for you, which is hard. Okay, so we're about mid-June right now, so we'll have you here at least 2 more weeks at the Wednesday market.
If the creeks don't rise.
Okay, alrighty. Well, they can look for you. Bob Poole, you're also known as Kincaid Farms. Or just ask for the young berry guy, and everybody knows where to find you. All right, Bob. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We're visiting now with Samantha Barnes, who is the owner of a wonderful program called Kitchen Kid. And it's a cooking school for children. And she's here at the market today. Of course, she's going to be sourcing ingredients for the class. So, Samantha, tell us a little more about the program this summer and maybe share a recipe with us.
We do cooking classes, as you said, at First Pres and throughout different locations in LA. We've got 7 weeks of summer programming going on with delicious recipes and themes like celebrity chef. And we bake cookies for the West Side Food Pantry one of the days so that kids learn about giving to others and how that's important for food. And then, of course, on Wednesdays, we come to the market here.
Harry and I, actually, the producer of Good Food, actually went to the graduation ceremony last year, and the kids were like serving this amazing buffet of food that I probably couldn't have cooked myself at home. It was really, really fabulous.
It starts June 27th, and one of the recipes that we'll be cooking this summer is for beet pasta. And I always think it's fun to cook with kids recipes that they're maybe not so... They're a little anxious about seeing. And something like that would be beet, something that comes from the farmer's market, that comes from the ground, that's maybe a little scary looking. But beets have all the makings for great kid food. They're nutritious, they're colorful, they're easy to prepare.
They stain.
they stain your fingers, but it washes off. But really, they're great things for kids. And yet, they're not. We don't think of them as being a kid food. If you prepare the beets, you can either roast them or boil them and then quarter them and put them in the food processor. And meanwhile, go ahead and cook some of your favorite pasta. I like to do it with farfalle because what happens is
the little bow ties.
The bow ties, yeah. But we pretend that they're butterflies. Uh-huh. And so when you mix the beets mixture, and you can add some ricotta or some cheese in there to make it a little bit creamier, but it gets, you know, bright, bright, bright magenta pink. And the minute it touches the pasta turns bright pink. So it's a really colorful food. The beet flavor is pretty mellow, and if you toss it with some ricotta, some parmesan, I also like to brown some butter and then add poppy seeds and toss it with that. It is the sweetest, nuttiest pasta. Kids love it. It's creamy and it's bright and fun to eat. So kids that maybe don't like a scary looking root vegetable like a beet, they like it at the end. It's really good.
Okay, well, Samantha, thank you so much. This is very inspiring, and the beet recipe just sounds like it's going to be too much fun to make, so thanks.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Samantha Barnes. She is the founder and head chef at Kitchen Kid, which teaches cooking classes for children at sites adjacent to farmers markets around Southern California. And, of course, we're lucky to have her right next to the Santa Monica Market on Wednesdays, beginning on June 27th. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Samantha Barnes has a recipe for beet pasta on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Also on the blog is a feature we call Ask Evan. Listeners send me questions about anything and everything related to food. This week, Betty asked what she should do with purple asparagus. My recipe ideas are on the blog. Facebook's the best place to submit a question. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Last year, we covered reporter Joel Grover's CanBC expose of some Southern California farmers markets. They were caught selling produce that was labeled as organic, but wasn't. And some farmers were selling produce that they did not grow themselves, breaking the crucial no middleman rule. After a series of listening sessions around the state, Sacramento took steps to better enforce farmers' markets. Joining me today is David Karp. He's a pomologist here in Southern California, and he writes the Market Watch column for the LA Times. David has an update on what's going on with farmers market regulation. So what happened after the listening sessions?
Well, the state arranged for a technical planning committee to meet five or six times, mostly in Sacramento and around the state. It was composed of stakeholders, farmers market managers, farmers, public representative, and they came up with a plan, a document that's available online. And that plan involves raising the fee from the currently market vendors, produce vendors, pay 60 cents for each farmer's market that they attend. And that goes to the California Department of Food and Agriculture for a skeleton program. Skeleton, I mean, that's basically an enforcement and regulatory program that has just enough money to pay for an administrator, a secretary, and to keep the lights on, and maybe for 1/6 of an inspector.
60 cents a market. So if a farmer goes to 10 markets, which is very common, they pay $6.
A week, yeah. Even a very small vendor must sell at least $200. Larger ones can sell up to $5,000 in a market. So it's a small fraction of their sales. It's also a very small fraction of the total amount of cheating that goes on at farmers markets, but I'm a little bit ahead of myself. So the Tactical Planning Committee proposed setting the cap of that fee as high as $4. Now, that doesn't mean that they would actually raise the fee to $4. All that would do, that would allow the Certified Farmers Market Advisory Committee to set a fee that it could be 1 cent, it could be a dollar, it could be $2, it could be $3, or it could be as high as $4, but no higher. That would raise a total of $1.5 million if it were set at $4, which would allow the hiring of 3 inspectors and 1 supervisor, one for Northern, one for Central, and one for Southern California. It would also devote about $500,000 to the county agricultural commissioners, so the front line of enforcement. They're the ones who issue the certified producer certificates and perform the inspection if somebody's the veracity of somebody's sales is questioned. They vary considerably. There are 53 counties or so in California. They vary considerably in their dedication to the task of ensuring farmers market integrity. The first thing that you hear when the market manager calls one of them up and says, can you inspect such and such a farm, is very often they'll say, you know, we really don't have the manpower, the resources to do this. So that would fund them as well as the state program. And then the other $500,000 would go to anytime you fund anything with the state, it has to pay for their future benefits and God knows what, for their share of keeping the lights on in the state capitol.
So basically what this is about is actually creating a system for enforcement to protect the consumer so the consumer knows that when they go to a farmer's market and they buy directly from a farmer, they are in fact buying directly from a farmer, growing locally, selling what he says he is selling.
Very well put. So where are we right now and why are we where we're at? Well, the Technical Planning Committee's proposal was barely accepted in a very close vote, 8-7. The Certified Farmers Market Committee agreed in March to receive this report. Then each 5 years, the Certified Farmers Market Program sunsets. That is, the authorization for it in state law expires every 5 years. And it so happens that the end of this year is just when it's going to expire. So Senator Anthony Cannella, Republican of Ceres of the state Senate, has come up with sponsored bill SB 513. Which, in addition to dealing with chicken fats and greases, also deals, believe it or not, with the renewing the Certified Farmers Market Program. If it were to sunset, by the way, the farmers markets wouldn't go away, just the state supervision of them would cease. We thought that perhaps, given all the support here in Southern California for farmers market integrity measures, that actually he would put something in SB 513 taking into account the Technical Planning Committee's proposal. Guess what? Not at all. It's already passed the state Senate, the 3 hearings and votes. And SB 513 is just like the corresponding measure was 5 years ago. The cap is set at 60 cents, which is just where it is right now. Enough to pay basically for the police station and for the electricity, but for no policeman.
So it's basically to pay for the room, but no person to inhabit the room.
That's right. And we get like something like 1/6 of an inspector per year, which for the whole state of California and 700 farmers markets is not nearly enough. A lot of people are suspicious of giving more money to state government, especially in the current political climate. And what I've heard time and time again is, look, we're already giving them $180,000 and we're not seeing any enforcement.
It's a big state. There's a lot of farmers at farmers markets. $180,000?
And let's look at it another way. Nobody's really done an estimate of what the total sales are at the 700-plus certified farmers markets in California. But my guess, I did a study some 12 years ago that's the closest, I believe, to anything along the lines. My ballpark figure is around $300 million of certified produce sold at those farmers markets in a year. My best guess is that a minimum of 10% and probably more like 20% to a quarter of everything that's sold at farmers markets is produce not of the farmer's production. In other words, something that they basically bought wholesale or from a neighbor. So we're talking about $30, $60 million or more of fraud every year. Compare that with the $1.5 million that's being called upon, even for the relatively expensive state program to make sure that farmers are actually growing what they sell. Okay? I do believe that by spending that $1.5 million, you'd probably cut down on half the fraud within a couple of years. So I think there's a good bang for the buck ratio. But I've spoken to a lot of agricultural commissioners, farm bureaus, and those who run certified farmers market groups who have said, look, we want to do it our way. We don't believe the state's ever going to perform this task efficiently. So what we're going to do is we'll be our own policemen. We'll hire inspectors to audit their vendors. Couple things. Again, I'm not sure that they can do that unless they're working with the state, because the state's the only ones that would have records of where these vendors are selling at and make sure that right now a lot of the certified producer certificates are worthless because all they say is like 10 acres of peaches. They don't specify by variety. That's just opening up a huge loophole the size of a Mack truck for cheaters to drive through. The other thing is I always say, what about all the smaller farmers markets in lower and middle income areas? Don't they deserve a farmers market of integrity?
Because the market managers there also don't have the resources to make a lot of farm visits.
Yes. Many of them actually care about integrity, but they work during the week and they just operate this farmers market on weekends. And when I've said to some of them, can't you go and verify whether so-and-so who's 200 miles away is actually growing those cherries? She's just started to laugh and said, you have no idea what my life is like. Three kids, three jobs, doing this on weekends on a shoestring. I think it's the state's responsibility to protect the consumer. When you go to a supermarket and buy wild salmon, do you want to take a forensic specimen of that and send it off to a lab? Or do you expect somebody to actually be inspecting that and making sure that you're getting what you're paying for?
Thank you so much, David.
Okay, thanks very much for inviting me, Evan.
I've been talking with David Karp, who writes the Market Watch column for the LA Times. More about this issue is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, celebrate Father's Day around the grill. You're listening to Good Food. Stay tuned. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. Tomorrow's Father's Day, and like many people, you might be spending it around the grill. There's something about men, meat, and fire. Joining me today in the studio is Frank Ostini. He's the owner of the Hitching Post 2 in Buellton, which specializes in Santa Maria barbecue. He's here with me in the studio to explain just what that means.
Well, it's cooking over an oakwood fire. It's something that the Native American Chumash Indians did long before we were here. And the Spanish came 200 years ago, brought the ironwork grill that goes up and down that we use in our region. And my family's been doing it for 60 years. It's basically cooking over a live oak fire, coast live oak, and real basic seasonings. The basics are salt, pepper, and garlic. And we use a red wine vinegar and vegetable oil basting while we're cooking. It's real simple.
Describe how the grill is different from a lot of the Weber grills that some of us might have at home.
Well, most grills are stationary as far as how far away they are from the fire. And ours goes up and down because we run this wood fire in it. It can be a low amount of heat or a high amount of heat. And you have to be able to control the temperature of the grill surface. So you're able to run up and down, usually 12 inches or maybe 18 inches, so you can get really far away from the fire if you have to.
And it's like a crank pulley system that does it.
Yeah, there's so many different variations of it. Some people use boxes that go up and down from a stationary grill to achieve the same thing. But the normal thing is for the grill to go up and down, and some are chains, some have gearing systems. We have some elaborate gears on ours that make it, and some elaborate chain work to run it up and down.
So when you're using wood as the fuel instead of wood charcoal, what characteristics does that give you?
Well, the wood has a lot more oils, and charcoal's made from wood, but it's sort of almost like pre-burned, and a lot of the character inside of it is been removed to just have carbon left over. So charcoal doesn't have very much flavor. Oak wood has a really dramatic smoke flavor about it. And we tried, of course, age the wood for 6 months so that it's dry enough to burn clean. And then we have a science of building the fire very gently and keeping the wood with a lot of airflow going through it so that it will burn very clean. We don't like a dominant flavor of smoke in most of the food that we cook. We like a balance of flavors. Our sense of responsibility of as chefs is that the food should taste of the protein or vegetable that you're actually eating, and then everything else is complements that. And so it's a balance of flavors that makes it enjoyable.
Describe the character of Oakwood versus mesquite. I think a lot of people in our part of the world tend to use mesquite. That's what we seem to find really easily at stores.
And is that, Evan, mesquite charcoal or mesquite wood, real mesquite wood?
No, I think I'm actually thinking about mesquite charcoal,
yeah.
Probably.
So mesquite charcoal has, it makes a very hot fire, which is good. It doesn't impart the same sort of smoke character that we get from our oak. And I think because it is so hot, charcoal can make an extremely hot fire. We usually get a real crispy, charred kind of character, which has its place, and it's kind of a strong character. And we have it in our wood fire also, but we try to sort of balance the sort of caramelization browning that happens on the grill with the seasonings that we use and the smoke flavor added. So all those things added together sort of make something more than any of them by themselves, and neither of the components stick out. So for me, there's just no of that smoke character that we get to add complexity to the food when you're using charcoal.
You have a really interesting technique to keep the meat juicy that involves how often you turn it and how you baste. Could you describe?
Oh, well, there's two schools on how you keep the juice inside of a piece of meat. Some people go that, and it probably works, is charring the outside of the meat will again create sort of a dry crust that will hold the moisture in. But we use a different technique because we know that with the heat of our fire, which is pretty strong, that if you put a piece of meat on the grill and leave it on without turning it, the heat of the fire will push the juices straight out the top of the meat. And you can see it sometimes when you're cooking that you start to see it ooze out the top. And that's a signal that you've waited too long to turn it over, because our style, we turn often so that we keep the juices inside. Before the juices come out the top, we turn it over and start the process of pushing up again with the heat to hold the juices inside of the meat. The flavor is all in the juices, so we're always trying to keep that. And so we turn a lot, using the heat to change the direction of the juice and keep it all inside the meat while it's cooking.
What are the most traditional cuts for a Santa Maria barbecue?
Well, the most traditional was the top sirloin, the block sirloin. And then in the last 30, 40, 50 years, the tri-tip cut was kind of invented in our region. And that became the most popular Santa Maria style cut to use. We don't use that cut in our restaurant, because it actually requires a long, slow cooking. In our system, people place orders, tell us how they want it cooked, and then we cook it. And so we're using sort of the higher cuts that when you have high-quality meat, you can cook it faster. You don't have to do the slow cook. Some of the tougher cuts require slow cooking. Tri-tip is sort of that way, not as much as brisket, which, of course, you have to really slow cook for many, many hours. And it's not usually done on the open grill like we do.
And what role does the direction of the grain or fibers of the meat play in having a nice, tender result?
Well, we always try to cook, not most of the time, with the grain running up and down. So it's the same direction as the heat is going. And the thought is that the heat will actually spread the grains apart, and that will tenderize the cut of meat. Sometimes you have cuts like the tri-tip where the actual grain is running the other direction sideways, and if you use intense heat on that, you actually smash the grains together, and it will make it even tougher So you slow cook that so that you don't put that pressure against it. So we also always try to cut against the grain so that when you're eating a piece, you have short lengths of grain. It'll be more tender than if you cut with the grain. You just have these long sort of strings of muscle fibers that are make it seem more chewy than it has to be, depending on how you cut it. So we're sometimes when we've cooked the steak with the grain going up and down, when it's time to cut it, we will cut it at an angle to try to cut across the grains so that the slices aren't just grain going up and down. So if you have the grains going up and down and you cut straight up and down, then you end up with longer strands of muscle fibers.
Which you want to avoid.
If you can, yeah. I mean, depending on the cut, some of them, it doesn't matter. Filet mignon's going to melt regardless. In New York, if you've aged it correctly, is going to be really tender. And that's another thing. We age our, these certain cuts require longer times of aging because we get tenderizing done in the aging process.
Frank Ostini is the chef owner of the Hitching Post 2 in Buellton in the Santa Ynez Valley. Menu suggestions for your Santa Maria barbecue and a recipe for tri-tip is on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Grilling in the Santa Maria style is just one way to go. Joining me with many other ideas is Shuji Sakai, also known as Professor Salt. He writes for the OC Weekly, and he competes in barbecue competitions across California with his team, 4Q Barbecue. He's got some great ideas for what to throw in the grill.
I've been sort of fascinated with sausages lately. There's so many varieties of sausage out there that you can buy, not just the usual brats. Nothing wrong with brats. Love those. But there's a few new sausage shops opening up that are offering things like wild boar Balinese sausage, duck bacon and jalapeno sausage. It's really interesting what these new shops are coming up with.
That wild boar Balinese, what's the flavor profile of that?
It's sort of like a gamier tasting pork, but it's still not, it's not a strong tasting pork, but it's flavored with Indonesian spices. So it goes really well with the sambal balado that this place makes, which the sambal is, it's like a tomato concasse almost, but it's, again, it's a very Indonesian, Southeast Asian flavor profile.
And where can you purchase those?
This is at a restaurant called Valhalla Table. It's in Costa Mesa. They have been open for just under 2 years now.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. These sound terrific. Give us some more ideas.
Well, this place opened up in Costa Mesa as sort of a longing, I guess, for a place in Los Angeles called Wurstkuche, which is in downtown L.A., and they also make exotic sausages such as a rattlesnake and rabbit sausage with jalapeno. That's also really good. And Wurstkuche is a restaurant where you can go. It's almost like a German beer hall, big open space with, you know, long communal tables where you could sit down and have your really good beers and really good sausages. However, they also will sell you the raw product that they make, and you can take that and cook that at home.
That's fantastic to know. Before we get into more places, are there tips that you have for grilling sausages? Do we just throw them on the grill? Do we need to pierce them first?
You know, that's something that you'll have a lot of opinions on. My personal thing when I cook sausage is that I will set up the grill so that you have a moderate heat zone on one side of the grill and a hotter heat zone on the other side. First of all, I cook with charcoal, and this is something you can also do with gas grill, but the important point is that you want to start your sausages over moderate heat. That is to say, if you hold your hand over the grill about 5 inches above the grate, you should be able to hold your hand there for between 5 and 8 seconds before you pull your hand away. It shouldn't be searing hot, or else what's going to happen is that the skin of the sausage will just char and the inside will not be cooked yet.
And then there's the problem of the exploding sausage.
Yes. And again, I think that if you cook it slowly over moderate heat with the grill covered, that it will roast slowly and you don't have this explosion where the fat and the meat expands inside the skin and splits it.
Which is the reason why some people decide to pierce the sausages.
Yes, that's right. But see, the problem with piercing it is that you lose all the juices and the fats that are inside that sausage. So yes, there's a benefit to it, but then you have the problem of all this grease leaking out, and if you're dripping grease on top of your flame, flare-ups, which leads to burning.
So do you have more sausage shops for us?
There's a couple. Down here in Orange County, there's a shop that's been around forever called Sabatino's in Newport Beach. They're right on the water. And they make an Italian sausage that I think is one of the best we have in this area. It's a coarser ground meat filled with chunks of sheep's cheese and with parsley. So it's got a huge amount of flavor. It's good on the grill, but because of all the cheese, it's an aged sheep's cheese. So it does have a high salt content. I think it's probably better to use in a sauce where some of that's the flavor and salt will flavor your tomatoes. But it's also really good on the grill if you can deal with a little bit more salt content.
If you're just joining me now, I'm talking with Shuji Sakai, a competitive barbecuer and food writer. He's sharing some cuts of meat he loves to throw on the grill.
Tri-tip, you know, classic California cut, is something you don't want to necessarily grill over high heat, just like sausage. You want to set it off to the side over moderate heat, close the lid, and let the heat from the charcoal off to the side roast your meat slowly. I'll be talking about something called a reverse sear on the OC Weekly blog, and that is to say, instead of searing the meat high heat first and then moving it off to indirect heat, I do it the other way around. So the benefit to that is that the meat cooks more evenly. A tri-tip, fairly good chunk of meat, will take me about 40 minutes. I'll do about 20 minutes per side indirect, and then finish it over the hot coal so that I get a good char profile at the very, very end.
Now, when you're shopping for the meat for tri-tip, do you go to a certain butcher shop whose meat you like the best?
There's a couple of ways to do that. I actually end up buying my meat at Costco for the most part when I buy tri-tip. They're usually selling USDA choice grade meat or better. And at Costco, typically they will peel the meat for you, which is to say the roast comes in with a big fat cap and a lot of silver skin and membrane underneath it. You can save a little bit of money, and if you have a sharp knife and you're pretty good with it, you could take that off yourself. But the stuff they sell at Costco, they've already done that for you.
Now, carne asada, what part of the animal are you using for that?
That's a part of the steer that comes from the belly part of it. It's like the diaphragm part. It's either called flat meat or flank steak, and it varies according to whatever butcher you're buying it from. But it's a thin piece of steak that has a huge amount of flavor, and it's easy to marinate yourself, or of course you could go out and buy pre-marinated.
I really love that cut, because every once in a while, you know, we get so used to this idea that all meat has to be extremely tender, and I think some of the appeal of some grilled meat is more the flavor, even if your teeth have to work a little more.
That's exactly right. Recently, I've been eating a lot at the taco trucks we have here in Orange County, and there's a cut called Suadero, which is also from that general area, sort of the between the abdomen and the rear hind legs. And it's a wonderful cut that I can't exactly say, okay, that's the part of the animal, or this is the exact muscle, I should say. And it's got such a wonderful texture. It's chewy, but then if you crisp it up, it's phenomenal. And it's hard to find at retail, Suadero.
And that's the kind of grilled meat that's wonderful to pair with really assertive sauces like a chimichurri.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got a lot of flavor on its own just because it's a muscle that's well used, and it does, like you say, have a little bit of fight to it, which is nice.
I would assume that you don't buy yours pre-marinated, so how do you prep it for the grill?
If I do carne asada, it's a really simple thing. You know, for every pound of meat, I'll use a tablespoon or so of olive oil or vegetable oil, a couple of chile serrano. I'll use two large cloves of garlic, just kind of peeled and crushed, and just a little bit of lime juice to taste, along with salt and pepper. You could rub that on there and let that marinate for a couple of hours, and you could go straight to the grill with it.
Give us some poultry ideas that aren't just chicken.
Chicken's hard to cook, in my opinion. It's, you know, it's technically demanding, but smoked turkey legs, I think, are underappreciated. It's something that you could buy once a year at the county fair, and you never think of them otherwise. But you can buy these things at Whole Foods Market, because they take whole turkeys, they cut them up in-house, and grind them up into turkey meat. So for about anywhere from $1.59 to $1.79 a pound, you could take fresh turkey legs, brine them, and then grill them, or actually smoke roast them on your grill at home. Again, set this off to the side over medium heat. Have a chunk of wood inside your grill. Let it roast for about anywhere from 60 minutes to 90 minutes, depending on how hot that vessel is.
What other cuts of meat do you have for us?
So the tomahawk steak is a rib steak that still has the bone attached. So it's got a big old handle on it, and that's why they call it a tomahawk steak. It's typically maybe 2, almost 3 inches thick, and it's not a steak per se more than a small roast. So if you're spending this kind of money on a really premium cut of meat like this, I like to go simple. Rub it with olive oil. Rub it with garlic, salt, and pepper, and do that reverse sear method that I talked about where you're starting over a moderate heat first, let it cook slowly, and then do the finish sear at the very end.
Anything else?
Similar to the tomahawk steak is the pork equivalent of it, the pork rib chop. It's, you know, the rib on pork steak, which if you cut that, also a thick piece of meat, brine it with a little bit of brown sugar, a little bit of salt, some spices, whatever you like. That, again, I will buy at places either at Whole Foods, Costco, believe it or not, does a really good job with those kind of things. So I try to hit the places that are easy to find and have good meat.
Thank you so much, Shuji.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
I've been talking to Shuji Sakai, food writer and competitive barbecuer. His grilling recommendations are on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, how a group of nuns is challenging fast food giant McDonald's. That's in 1 minute right here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Welcome back to Good Food. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. Earlier this year, a group of nuns, the Sisters of St. Francis of Philadelphia, sponsored a resolution that would require McDonald's to report on the health issues related to items on their menu. While McDonald's has made significant attempts to introduce healthier options on their menu, the sisters also want to make sure that they're marketing them as such. But why is McDonald's listening to a group of nuns? Well, they own about $2,000 worth of stock in the company. They recently submitted a resolution at the annual shareholders meeting. I'm speaking with Thomas McCaney. He's the Associate Director of Corporate Social Responsibility for the Sisters of St. Francis in Philadelphia.
The resolution asked the company to report on the effectiveness of their efforts to combat childhood obesity.
How does a resolution work at a shareholder meeting?
You have to obviously own shares of the company. If you own at least $2,000 worth of shares for no less than 1 year prior to the annual meeting, you may submit a resolution to the company. At that point, the company will evaluate it to see if it fits the criteria to be able to be presented, not just at the annual meeting, but to be sent out in their annual proxy statement to be voted on by all the shareholders. And in this case, the company did deem it appropriate, not that, you know, that they did not want to challenge it with the SEC, which companies sometimes do. They decided that they would not fight it and put it out on the ballot.
Did this idea of submitting a resolution come up because they felt a bit at odds with their investment?
To a certain extent, yes. The Sisters of St. Francis have not only a portfolio of investments, but they have what they consider a special account, a small percentage of their investments set aside in an account that is really just with mostly larger companies in order to work with those companies on issues of environment, social, and governance issues.
Because that's really the only way corporations will change is if they understand that they have self-interest to do so.
We think so. We think that's the best way to do it. And as I said, we try to present the business case. So we think that our companies can do well by doing good.
So let's go back to McDonald's. Do you think they're really trying to present themselves as a healthy option for children?
Well, they have self-identified as leaders. They're certainly leaders in the restaurant business. No one would dispute that. But they've identified themselves as leaders with nutrition. They've worked with Michelle Obama and are on a White House committee as a resource on nutrition.
So do you think it's just a ploy, or do you think that they're really invested in coming up with healthy options?
We're pretty optimistic with McDonald's. We think that they've done a lot of good when it comes to their menu items. If you've noticed in the past few years, they've added some healthy choices. We think we're still a little concerned with maybe some inconsistencies in their message, but we're generally happy with their transparency and their willingness to be open about the process. And they've dialogued with our group on a few occasions on this subject.
So let's talk about if kids are actually choosing the healthy options. Do people order the apple slices instead of the French fries?
That's a good question. I don't have statistics nationally, but certainly the Center on Science in the Public Interest did a small study recently, and they found that 93% of the time that they ordered the Happy Meals, French fries were basically the default choice unless the customer asked for apple dippers.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I'm sure the apple slices cost the franchises more than the French fries.
Yeah, I would think so. Although McDonald's, they'll tell you they're very proud that they're the largest purchaser of apples in the United States right now.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So after you submitted the resolution to them and they shared it with the shareholders, what response did you get?
As I said, we had dialogued with them. I met with McDonald's representatives prior to the annual meeting, like an hour before the annual meeting. And they, as I said, they're willing to continue to talk with us and to get our feedback and our impressions on what we see of their efforts. And then in the annual meeting, the votes were tallied, and our proposal received 6% of the vote, which sounds like a pretty small percentage. But for a resolution of this nature, we were pretty happy. It certainly gives us the option. You have to have a minimum of 3% in order to present it next year, the next year. So we've preserved that option that we can do that if we choose to.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thomas McCaney is the Associate Director of Corporate Social Responsibility for the Sisters of St. Francis in Philadelphia. Time now for Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins us here every week. Today, we're heading to familiar territory, San Gabriel for noodles.
Vietnamese noodles, and not pho, but Central Vietnamese noodles.
And what is the difference?
Pho is like a specific kind of noodle that's usually in the spiced beef broth. And the big noodle of Central Vietnam is something called bun bo huay, which is a rice noodle in a very funky broth that is flavored typically with pig's foot.
Is it a pork broth with specifically extra pig feet?
You know, I've never made it. I don't know whether it's a beef broth or a pork broth. I know that the pig's foot is in there for the extra special barnyard aroma that it adds, and also because it adds a really nice gelatinous quality to the broth.
Oh, that's great. So you actually get the pig foot to eat.
You get a little bit of the pig's foot. Nhat Trang is different from a lot of the noodle shops in the San Gabriel Valley. It's, or at least the Vietnamese ones, it's very small, maybe 6 tables. there's always a line to get in. They make only a certain number of portions of each dish each day. So if you come when the bun bo wei is gone, you're out of luck. You have to get something else.
And what else is there to get?
I thought you would never ask. There's usually 8 noodles. Sometimes there'll be a special or two. But you could get the, I always pronounce this wrong, mi quang, which is like a thick fettuccine noodle that's tinted yellow with turmeric, which is in just a puddle of broth, just enough to moisten it, not a big hunkin' bowl of broth. But it comes with peanuts and crunchy rice crackers that are studded with sesame seeds and a handful of pungent herbs.
Wow, that sounds really delicious and unique.
It's a really good dish. Every good Central Vietnamese noodle shop will have it, which sounds glib maybe, but there are probably half a dozen that also do good versions of the dish. But this one is nice. It's a little brothier than the rest of them. The rice crackers are somehow extra crunchy, and somehow they're really nice when they sog up a little bit of the broth. You get the contrast of the chewy and the light and crispy. The pho that they have is a pho ga, which is not beef noodle soup, but it's a chicken noodle soup. Really clean tasting, really pure broth. The people who love the restaurant claim that they don't use MSG. And I haven't been in the back to, like, monitor the bottles of Maggi that may or may not be in there. But it's a beautiful chicken soup. There's something called the bun ryu. And bun are like the round noodles that kind of spaghetti looking. When you get it at the wrong restaurant, sometimes tastes like ketchup and canned fish. But when it's done right, has a sort of really delicate, slightly sour tomato quality to it.
It almost sounds Indian in that sort of tamarind inflected way.
It could well be. I mean, Indochina doesn't have the Indo in front of it for nothing. You know, India is not very far away. And there's, you know, these wonderful fluffy meatballs in that soup. And when you mix in a little of the chili sauce in this sort of violently purple fermented shrimp paste, it's noodles in 3 dimensions.
Mm, sounds great.
That's about it. I mean, you can get the same meatballs in, like, tomato sauce that come with, like, a chunk of baguette. So I guess you could make yourself a Vietnamese meatball hoagie. And there's a version of Hainan chicken rice, which is pleasant enough, but probably not the very best in town. It's actually almost the pho ga in, like, solid rice form, but the texture of the rice is maybe a little soggier than I would prefer anyway. Like I said, you're probably going to go there. You're probably going to, unless it has sold out, get yourself some bun bo wei, which was hot with fresh chilies and, like, flavored with lemongrass and has a lot of the meat from the pig's knuckle. But unless you ask for it, they're not going to put in giant chunks of congealed pig's blood.
You can't ask for it.
You can ask for it, yes.
Sounds really delicious. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
We've been talking about Nha Trang on East Valley Boulevard near Atlantic in Alhambra. Get the exact address of Nha Trang and all of Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations sent to your cell phone. Just text the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And see all of his recommendations on the Good Food Restaurant map. That's on our blog at kcrw.com/Good food. When Good Food returns, I'll take you out for a taste of Mongolia. Stay tuned. This is Good Food.
Hi, everyone. This is Eddie Lin for KCRW's Good Food, Mongolia. It's a large landlocked country sandwiched between Russia to the north and China to the south. A large percentage of Mongolia's inhabitants exist within a nomadic or semi-nomadic lifestyle. A lot of animal fat is necessary for the Mongols to tolerate the cold winters. Winter temperatures can be as low as minus 40 degrees Celsius. Today, we're going to experience a little bit of Mongolia's people, culture, and food right here in downtown LA near City Hall at the Mongolian Cultural Days event. And here with me is the organizer.
My name is Zula. I'm representing Los Angeles Mongolian Association. And we are organizing the Mongolian Cultural Day and the first time ever in Los Angeles City.
Now, how big is the Mongolian population in Los Angeles?
In Los Angeles City, there are 2,000 to 3,000 Mongolians live in Los Angeles City.
But wow, so it's a very small population.
Yes, compared to other Asians, but compared to whole Mongolian population is 2.8 million. And compared to that, there are a big group of Mongolians live in Los Angeles City.
So we have a food guide with us now at the Mongolian Cultural Days. Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Sarne Judson, and I'm a stay-at-home mom and a foodie.
And you're Mongolian?
Of course, yes. Basically, I grew up on three basic things eating, which was meat, lots of meat, mostly mutton and some beef. But I've had camel meat, I've had horse, and goat is the third common meat. So basically, it was meat, red meat, flour and dairy. That's it.
I have a burning question about Mongolian barbecue in the U.S. Is it authentic?
Not at all. There's nothing Mongolian about it. It has all kinds of vegetables that we don't have or we don't grow, and spices that we don't eat, herbs that we don't have or grow, and lots of meat like chicken and pork. We do have a little bit of chicken and pork, but we don't eat it much. So I think it's more a Chinese invention than Mongolian.
What booth are we going to try first here?
First stop is fermented mare's milk. Of course, the mare's milk is, American mare's milk. I've tried it earlier. It's not as good as home, of course, but it can be delicious and it's refreshing, and everybody drinks it from, 3-year-old to 80-year-old. Normally, it has a very little percentage of alcohol, about 3%. Depending on the season.
I've had a lot of different drinks in my life, a lot of bizarre things to drink. Alcoholic horse's milk probably will top them all. So let's try this. So she's serving it out of a big bucket. Okay. The mare's milk is quite sour, actually.
It can be, yes.
But there's definitely an alcohol element to it.
I just asked the lady who's selling it, I asked if it was real mare's milk. She said she got them. Apparently now in Mongolia, they dry the mare's milk and make it powder. So she brought some powder from Mongolia to make this.
But is it already fermented?
No, they fermented here. Traditionally, it's they milk the mares, and they have this big cow skin bag in the yurt, and then they pour it to the cow skin bag, and they have this long wooden sticks, so they just stir it 1,000 times. That's what the teenagers or children's job. They, in the summer, they go visit your relative or grandma, grandpa, and they stir fermented mare's milk until it's, reaches the point.
It tastes kind of like yogurt, but with a little bite. I like it. So where are we now?
We're at the station where they're selling horseshoe and bods, which are very traditional Mongolian dishes. Horseshoe is the deep-fried, flattened dumplings, and bods is the steamed dumplings. And the stuffing is always 100% meat. Mongolians are not big into veggies, so it's traditionally lots of mutton, but here I'm pretty sure it's all beef.
I'm looking at a very elaborate kind of, it almost looks like pretzels stacked on top of each other, and then a bunch of biscuits and tube things covered with white powdered sugar, but I'm not sure what I'm looking at. What is this?
It's called hivim bov, which are deep fried donuts that are only made for special events like New Year's and festivals. And they make them and then they stack them on layers. And it always has to be odd numbers. And the higher the layers it is, you know, the wealthier or older the person is or the family's head is.
Yeah, it's very elaborate. It looks like, to me, it looks like a stack of pretzels arranged in a circle. And then there are all kinds of biscuits on top and little tube things that look like they have powdered sugar on it. But it just, I've never seen anything like it. This is Eddie Lin saying goodbye from the very first Mongolian Cultural Days in L.A. for Good Food.
See pictures of some of the things that Eddie ate at the Mongolia Cultural Days event on our blog. It's at kcrw.com/goodfood. Before we go, I want to devote a little time to pie. It's my favorite dessert, yes, still. And this time of year, I kind of think of myself as a pie point person, trying to spread the buttery crust gospel. Every day this summer, check out the Good Food blog for pie recipes. Share your pie adventures at KCRW's Facebook Pie Challenge and listen to our weekly bonus podcast, The Pie Cast. Download it from kcrw.com/goodfood. All this pie madness culminates with the third annual Good Food Pie Contest, which is happening on September 18th at LACMA. Okay, so what do I love about pie? Well, there literally isn't anything you can't do. Here's Carrie Kuzak, the chef owner of LA's Simple Things Sandwich and Pie Shop, with her family's chocolate cream pie recipe.
I eat pie often, probably every day. I grew up in the Ozarks, so I've always been surrounded by pie. Huge family tradition. Rather than cake, I was a pie kid. And for birthdays, Auntie Clara would always bake her chocolate pie for me, and I would have that in addition to cake. I am a big believer in the voluminous amount of whipped cream on a pie, but it has to be really great, not too sweet whipped cream, and then an abundance of chocolate shavings. I think that, especially for the chocolate pie, it's such a rich, dense, over-the-top kind of pie that the whipped cream actually helps to balance it in a way. Growing up, it was always just a traditional hand-rolled crust, but I've started doing a graham cracker crust here in the shop.
That was Carrie Kuzak of Simple Things Sandwich and Pie Shop. The recipe for her Aunt Clara's chocolate cream pie is on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood or from iTunes. Info on all of today's guests is on our website, where you'll also find links to food events around town, the Good Food blog, and much more. Good Food's produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Jillian Ferguson, Candace Moyer, and Lara Garcia. Becky Gebhardt edits the podcast. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Becky Nelson, Taryn Olson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.